the leader. Okay, this is continuing with Smith on 27 August 76.
A whole lot of observations came together, and I suppose naturally, if one thinks one's been working alone, one is confronted by other people doing the same thing, and one's immediate reaction is to say, well, my observations must be better, even if they're not unique.
Sure.
And I'm sure this happened quite strongly on both sides. As you know, there was quite a lot of feeling for some years between the Australians and the Cambridge group. And I think it was just that feeling that instead of finding that one was alone in the field, one found that one was working on very closely parallel lines. And so there was a pretty strong competitive feeling, to put it mildly.
Yes, yes. From a maybe more philosophy of science, it's sort of interesting to ask whether this working in parallel lines was an accident or not. I mean, was it sort of inevitable that once, you know, that if a group had been on another planet, that things would have developed the same sort of way?
I think that it was almost inevitable, because what had happened during the war was well known to both sides. The level of technical expertise was obviously similar in both places. Basic radio research had been held back, and so that there was a situation which was absolutely ready to be exploited, although nobody realised quite what the situation was. The Australian radiophysics was a strong institution which was able to carry on with basic research, and I think it was perfectly natural that both things did go in that direction.
But this is, of course, well after the war we're talking about now, 7-10 years afterwards, and still things are going parallel. But of course, you're having more communication with each other, which is locking you.
Yeah, I think the communication really only started seriously at about this time.
Yeah, yeah. That IRSI meeting, do you remember anything else about the status of radio astronomy? Is it radio?
Oh, well, I remember seeing Christensen's work on multiple element interferometers, the solar work, which I admired very greatly. I think that was very exciting, and of course Wild was also working on spectrum of solar bursts.
Right.
I found this all very impressive indeed, and I think it was from that time on that I knew that the Australians were not just competitors, they were really a very serious and large institution.
Well, coming down to the publications again, you have this article in the Proceedings of the Physical Society in 52 about the nitty-gritty details of how you measure the angular diameter of stars.
Yes.
And radio stars. Now, you've passed over rather lightly, but it seems to me that this article and a similar one about positions, in which you go through all the equations, like you say, really are very sort of basic, that no one else, you know, had done all these things.
Yeah, that's right.
Someone had to sort all these things out.
Yeah. Well, I think that it was fortunate that I got in on the group that was using the two-element interferometer rather than the group that was using the reflection in the sea, because this put me in a position to do just that work, you see.
Well, why do you say that? Because the two-element proved in the end to be more useful and
It's a more accurate technique, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, reflection in the sea is not a good thing because you're looking at the horizon, which is not a good place to look if you're worried about refraction either in the atmosphere or the ionosphere.
Right, but I still don't quite see what you're saying, because there are just as many, in fact, one could argue there are more problems that need to be worked out in terms of making it work. The tide levels and all this sort of thing with the sea interferometer.
Yes, there are more problems. What I mean is that it was fortunate not to be involved in the sea interferometer, which is where the Australians were. I was fortunate to be involved in the two aerial thing, where you've got a nice symmetrical situation, meridian and transit, and it was I was just there at the right time to work out how to use it.
I see what you're saying.
That's what I mean.
Okay, here's the one in Monthly Notices about the position of a radio star.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember presenting that paper in front of the Royal Astronomical Society, which was the first paper I presented to them.
Right.
In fact, you will find that one of the positional astronomers in Royal Greenwich Observatory, Andrew Murray, remembers my presenting this paper. Of course, he was already a positional astronomer at the time, and I think he must have regarded with a certain amount of amusement my elementary exposition of the principles of positional astronomy, which were involved in this. The thing I remember mainly is that I drew a fairly accurate circle on the board without making, at least making a botch of that.
Do you remember at all what sort of reception?
I think people were pleased to see that the accurate positions were coming out. Possibly, some of the conventional astronomers would begin to think that the radio astronomers were becoming respectable if they were able to measure positions to anything like that accuracy.
Mm-hmm. That's right, that's nothing in that. Yeah. Moving on, we have... Oh, this must have been a very side thing, but apparently you looked for radiation from Jupiter. Well, before we go to that, we should go to your sabbatical, I guess it was.
That's right, yes. This was just after I came back.
Right. So
right.
Can you tell me about that?
That was, I think, a result of Ratcliffe's influence in the group. Because I was very fortunate to go to that conference in Australia, and I came back via the States. And Ratcliffe said that I should call him at DTM.
Mm-hmm.
He, of course, had close connections through it because of its director in World 2.
Right.
And he said I should go there, and that was my first experience of the States. And soon after I got back to England, I was invited to go there for a year. They were already interested in radio astronomy, although they had started largely on the hydrogen line, and I felt this wasn't quite my way of working, because I knew a lot of people were working on the hydrogen line, or aspiring to, and I thought that I would just be one amongst many. So I wasn't particularly interested in their work on the hydrogen line, but they were starting up work on lower frequencies, recording the sun and so on. So it seemed to me that it would be a good place to work for a while. And so the only trouble was that I had a family, a wife, and three children. My wife was expecting a fourth, and so I reckon this made it quite impossible.
Yeah.
I went to Ratcliffe and said, look, I've got this extraordinary invitation. I can't imagine why they invited me, but in any case, I can't go because my wife's expecting a baby. His comment was quite straightforward. They have babies in America as well,
right.
You see, which apparently hadn't occurred to anyone else. And so I went. I had a marvellous time because it's a very good institution, very open-minded about directions of research, and I was given a free hand and told to think of something new to do, if I wanted to do something new. And so I said, okay, I don't want to work on the hydrogen line, let's try and pursue low-frequency radio astronomy. Everyone else is going up in frequency, let's try and go down. And so during that year, I was largely responsible for the big array on 21 megahertz, which subsequently discovered the signals from Jupiter.
Right.
I worked with Bernie Burke, who of course is still in the
right.
game. And we had a great time building this array.
I've talked to both Burke and Franklin about that discovery. Were you influenced by the fact that it was solar minimum to go to low frequencies at all?
Yes, I think this was in mind, that this was a good time to do it. It should be done at some time anyway, and this
right.
is a good time to do it.
And in fact, did you get to do any observations yourself?
Scarcely, no. We just about got the thing working, and I left the thing parked, so to speak, at declination 22, because the Crab Nebula came up, and IC443, and it was a good way of leaving the thing running to see it, to test its stability, you
mm-hmm.
see. And Bertie Burke will have told you the consequence that happened to be the declination Jupiter was at. That's an incredible piece of luck.
I see, but it was really your decision to pick these sources.
I think so, yes. Well, you know, Bernie Burke and I worked together on this, and we said, well, let's leave it running there. That's what we did.
When you visited America, did you go out to talk to Bada and Minkowski at that time?
Yes, I did. I met them then. Merle, too, was and is a marvellous character, and he said that I must cross the States and go and visit Pasadena. And so the whole family got in a Willis station wagon, and we just went across somehow or another. And so I met them there. In fact, I did some radio astronomy in California. Because one of the ideas that we had was that it might be a good idea to see if there were any genuine fluctuations. This goes back to the fluctuation story, which correlated over very large distances. And so I took out with me a 38 megahertz receiver, and I did install that temporarily on the top of Mount Palomar. read it there a few days.
I see. So this
I ran one at DTM in Washington, you see.
Right.
And I took another one out to Palomar. This is Cambridge.
This would be when, 53?
This was 53, yes.
So this was really the first radio astronomy done at Caltech.
It wasn't really a very good radio astronomy, but I did run this equipment with a couple of dipoles at the top of Palomar. It was the most inappropriate place because
right.
there was a transmitter not far away. But it made it quite clear that all the fluctuations we could see were ionospheric scintillations. None of them seemed to correlate over a large distance, which is what we were after.
Right.
So we wanted to see if there were any correlating over a large distance.
This little experiment has never been published.
No, it wasn't worth
publishing. Yeah.
I can see you've got the reprint there, which actually showed some pulses which might have been correlated over a distance of some 100 kilometers or so. We had that in mind.
You may remember I wrote you a letter asking you a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
What's in retrospect, what were these things? And you wrote back that it's still a complete mystery.
It's still a complete mystery. It may have just been a fluke. I think it was just an accident. I don't know.
This we're referring now to the 1950...
Yes. 1950 next year. Yes. Well, you see, I think we still had that in mind, that there might be something which would correlate over a large distance.
Yeah, that it could be a mixture of intrinsic
sure.
and...
Right, yes. Well, nothing ever showed up again, so that line died after time.
Now, so when you got back, you heard about the Jupiter discovery, I guess.
That's right. I said, well, let's try and get some radiation from that at the frequencies we had available.
38 and 81.
That's right. And, darn, maybe we couldn't pick it up.
which I suppose was a...
It was a surprise because that, of course, was narrowband radiation.
Right, no other source was acting like that.
That's right.
Okay. Next, I find Agee and Smith 56 on the spectra of four sources and of the background radiation. Can you tell me about that?
That's right. I think I became more interested in the galaxy than the point sources. I think you can see from the authorship of the survey papers that I wasn't very much in the point source game from then on. I became more interested in the galaxy, and working with Agee, we decided we would try to measure the spectrum as accurately as possible using scaled arrays. And of course we measured the point sources as well. We tried to get the spectral index by using scaled arrays at a series of frequencies. And that was I think quite a successful experiment, but full of a bit of academic stuff, if you like, in a way. It didn't produce anything very exciting.
Yeah, but someone had to do this sort of thing.
Oh yes,
and, yeah.
Oh yes. I think it was a good thing to do.
But I'm interested in your comments that you more or less dropped the radio star work. It would seem like it might have been natural for you, to having gotten these positions, and they were eminently successful in helping identifications. Why not to
I think there was a conscious decision within the group that we had to diversify our interests somewhat, you know, that is, spread our interests amongst the members of the group.
I see.
So I think I became more interested in galaxy at that time. You see, if you look ahead a bit to the satellite work, that was because we might be able to measure the low-frequency radiation from the galaxy. And I think that during these years, I still am interested in galaxy, actually, interstellar medium and so on.
Okay, next one I see here is Baldwin and Smith, 56, looking at M87.
Yes, that's right. That was another shot like Jupiter, just to see if you could get something slightly unusual. That's an interesting observation. I don't think I've ever really looked back to see whether what we saw in the form of a halo around...
Well, this abstract says extended low-level radiation with very intense central peak.
Well, the central peak was there, all right. But the low-level stuff over a rather larger area, I'm still not really quite sure whether there was anything in that at all, but that's what we did.
Well, but isn't it true that Virgo A does have a halo even in today's observations?
I'm not quite sure that it's all that big.
Yeah, oh, I see. I think
it's a special degrees, size. That's degrees we're talking about.
Oh, I see.
And I'm not really quite sure that there's any structure which can really account for those observations.
But then maybe no one's looked at such a low frequency since then.
Well, exactly, yes. Yeah. I think it's still a thing that should be checked up on.
And now here's an article with O'Brien and Baldwin in Monthly Notices 56
on
the Galactic Center.
Oh, it's on the Galactic Center. Oh, that's right, yes. Well, another shot to measure diameters and so on.
Script scans between 38 and 500 megacycles.
That's right. Yes. Okay.
But was it pretty clear that this Sagittarius A was probably the center of the galaxy, or was that what you were trying to determine here?
I think the experiment was just on, as one might have done, on almost any radio source, but it was obvious that this could be the center of the galaxy and might be a more interesting one than any other. I don't think we, again, started off saying we will work on the galactic center. What can we do on the galactic center? It's much more, here is an interesting radio source where we might be able to do something.
Right. Well, that's something I have to learn, because I've been trained in a rather different style.
Yes. Well, I think you have to appreciate that in those days one was measuring everything that one could measure.
Yeah.
It's certainly not true now.
Okay, Costain and Smith, monthly notices 60. Well, this is skipping ahead now.
This is
hitting a 0.8 degree beam at 8 meters.
That's right. Well, you see, we were very much occupied in moving observatories at that time. And Costain and Smith referred to the new observatory at Lord's Bridge.
Right.
So that a lot of work had gone in, including a lot of sheer constructional work on that array at that time. That array, of course, was for anything that you could see. It would be partly for point sources, but mainly to synthesize a map of the galaxy with good resolution at low frequencies. So it really reflects my interest in galactic structure.
So I always thought that John Baldwin was the primary one who was interested in the galactic background, but it appears that you and Baldwin together.
I think he certainly took over my interest eventually.
Yes. Yeah. But even then, he was working on the radio halo. And
he was, that's quite true, yes. Yes.
I guess you never got involved in the halo controversy.
Not really, no. Yeah. I think that was his, yes.
Along about this time, I don't run into it here, but Sputnik came along, and I'd be interested in your recounting of what happened.
Well, that was very exciting. We were all, I think, taken completely by surprise by Sputnik. Now let's think, who was it? I can't remember his name. He moved on to Birmingham and worked on things like Flight of Birds and so forth. I'll get him. George somebody.
Whitfield?
Whitfield, that's right. George Whitfield. He was the first to get the Sputnik, because being great enthusiast as he was, he dashed straight off to the observatory and showed that you could pick up signals from this thing with almost a piece of wet string. And within a day, we were discussing this and realizing that we could again measure something that maybe nobody else was measuring. Mm-hmm. It's again the same philosophy. You see, you don't decide to work on satellites and say, what can you do?
Yeah.
You say, here's something which we can do, which is new. And it looks as though it could be very interesting and bring you into a new field and so forth. So we all started joining in with enormous enthusiasm. And we were very soon realizing that we could measure an orbit or some parameters of the orbit. And we all worked like mad on this for several days. It was very exciting. And we then found ourselves in the position of being the authorities on the orbit of this darn thing. Because, of course, when Jodrell got working a bit later, they were doing radar from the rocket case, which is a different thing. So we were the authorities on the orbit. And in fact, Martin Rowell and myself eventually became the first people, as far as I know, to publish a new navigation system using satellites.
That's right, I came across that in a list of Cambridge publications.
Well, it's a very amusing thing, because, of course, people in the States have been working like mad on this and haven't published anything.
Right.
It was classified. this is just the way the innocence came along,
right.
Yes. So that, of course, has remained a very interesting subject, and followed it a bit. I find myself almost back in the field again now, incidentally, because such satellites are used for time comparisons, you see.
Right.
Anyway, we went along again as innocents, not knowing anything much about orbits. And after a couple of days, I was asking a mathematician friend of mine, David Rees, a member of my Cambridge college, about orbits of satellites and things and how you could possibly measure them Well, he looked at his orbit's precession and so forth, and he gave me one or two elementary lessons. But of course we ran into trouble with this one because we found the height of the satellite orbit changing, and we didn't realise how elliptical it was. And so after a while we were telling the excited press that the thing was coming down to lower altitudes.
Oh, yeah.
That was the orbit precessing. It was some time before we learnt. We learnt from all sorts of people, including the then science correspondent of The Guardian, Maddox, who was at one time a Manchester physicist.
I see.
And he was at that time science correspondent and joined a team of reporters who were actually watching this in operation. And we were discussing this problem about the change in altitude. And he said, would this help? And he brought a book out of his pocket, which he'd got from the States with some relevant information in it.
I see. So the journalist...
The journalist helped him.
Actually helped the scientists. Yes.
So that lasted for... it was a 9 days wonder, I suppose. Orbits of satellites.
I'd like to ask about a couple of meetings, namely the Jodrell Bank Symposium in 55.
Yes.
You gave a talk there about the galactic center, but...
Yes.
But more specifically, I'd like to ask about the atmosphere of it.
I think at that time we were beginning to feel that we were slotting in to a much larger community. At that time, that was the time, I think, when the Russians presented their work on synchrotron radiation, which, again, of course, one doesn't grasp things straight away, but we began to realize that... There was some good physics here, which we'd got to understand.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a year or two before we really grasped what they were saying. But nevertheless, there was a feeling that this was a good, solid scientific discipline, that there was lots to be found out about the structure of the galaxy, possibly structure of the universe, physics of sources, and so on. So I think it was actually a very constructive meeting from that point of view.
Yeah. Well, you say possibly structure of the universe, but that wasn't the way it was worded then.
Not really, no.
Right.
No. When we say exploring the universe, it's a broad term. not cosmology. We weren't really onto it then, were we?
Well,
when was the Paris Symposium?
58.
Well, there you
are. That was well after the storm was passed.
That's right. Yes, so we were talking about.
Yeah, the 2C was published in 55.
That's right. So we were well into it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And I guess also there were some optical astronomers there, which was also rather different.
That was exciting. Yes, that's right. Yes. Oh, I think that was really the beginning of modern radio astronomy about the time.
Now, at the Paris Symposium, the paper that you specifically talked about was Radio Astronomy of the Planets. And when I made this note, I was going to ask you why in the world that, but now I see.
Oh, I know
why there was a loose connection anyway.
I know why. Lovell was asked to give this paper originally, and he asked me if I would do it. That's one reason why. I was interested at that time in radiation from the moon, in particular thermal radiation from the moon. Just as a piece of physics, it was an interesting thing to try and work out, for example, sunlight reflected from the moon, and what would you expect the temperature of the moon to be, and so on.
And microwaves, you mean?
Microwaves, yes. Yeah. Right. So that yes, I was interested in the physics of radiation from the planets. Jupiter was part of it, I suppose.
Did you ever publish any of this lunar work?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
No, I think it only came out in the report of that meeting at Jodrell. Or the Paris Symposium, rather.
Yeah, this is the Paris Symposium, right.
Paris Symposium.
Well, the final publication I have here is of note. It's 1960, in which you gave a talk somewhere about some technical meeting on receiver technology needed for the future of radio astronomy.
Oh, yes.
What did you think at that time?
Well, I've been interested in technology all along. I think that's fair. I think I was probably one of the people doing most about switching circuits and low noise amplifiers and so forth. And it was quite clear that we had to improve low noise amplifier technology. That was the great thing that we were after. I don't think that I was thinking in any particularly original way about aperture synthesis and those sorts of techniques. I was much more interested in the in the electronics, the amplifiers things. So that's what I was talking about at that time.
Well, in fact, your name is not on any publications to do with Aptosynthesis. It's Ryland
Hewish.
But explicitly, though, what were you saying? I mean, were you thinking, for instance, that masers were the way to go?
Yes. I think that I was very much concerned about relationships of noise temperatures to background temperatures. And I would be pointing out that the sky background temperature fell with a certain law. The expected noise temperatures with known techniques would fall with different laws and so forth.
Yeah.
And if you could possibly get lower noise temperatures at higher frequencies, then you would have a very much greater sensitivity, and you could extend to somewhat higher frequencies.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think it is in noise temperature terms that I was thinking, rather than in the aperture synthesis terms. I mean, that was being done so well by Ryland Hewish anyway.
But the paper was only on receiver technology.
That's right.
So,
yeah. Well, that's why the paper was on receiver technology.
Now, I'm going to the early 60s, and I don't have the bibliography. Can you tell me, when did you leave Cambridge, actually?
64.
So that's a very natural place, then.
Yes.
Can you tell me what you worked on?
Of course, at that time, I was working on satellite radio astronomy.
While still at Cambridge?
Yes. Oh, yes. We did an experiment on a rocket carrying a low-frequency receiver high up, and this was a precursor of an experiment in the satellite Ariel 2.
And when did that go on?
Early 60s, but I can't remember the exact date.
The first rocket went up. Then.
The first rocket would be about 1960 or so.
And Ariel 2?
Ariel 2, a year or two later. Sorry, I haven't got the exact date.
Right, and this work was published where?
Ariel 2, some of that got published in Monthly Notices, I think. Yeah, that's right. Temperature of the galactic background at low frequencies.
And how low did you go?
Oh, this is about 3 megahertz. In fact, it was between I think we've got to go out because they're shutting the shop up. Wait a minute!
Oh, they won't shut it back, will they?
There's something in Monthly Notices on the spectrum of the galactic background, which goes down to low frequencies. The thing is that it's been somewhat superseded by work from Walsh, who's now at the bank. Haddock and Walsh did a very good rocket experiment.
Yeah, he told me about that.
That's right, yes. Well, it was it's on exactly the same subject. The answer wasn't far wrong, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, this this satellite, in just the same way as Walsh and Haddock, discovered the ionospheric noise bands, you see. And that was a bit worrying. And led to an experiment in Ariel 3 to follow it up.
Well, pardon my ignorance, but I don't know what ionospheric noise band.
Oh, the ionosphere produces some radiation at resonant frequencies, and it's got a lot of resonant frequencies because you've got magneto-ionospheric splitting in different modes and so on.
Oh, I see.
And you do get powerful noise bands, which are generated by high energy particles in the ionosphere, exciting some sort of resonant radiation.
I
don't think the thing is really properly understood. I mean, it's rather like Doppler shifted cyclotron radiation.
Yeah. So this galactic background work was with the satellite was not both really of your interest in the '50s.
Of trying to measure the spectrum of the galactic background.
Yes.
Now, this was still going when I moved to Jodrell, because I had to hand the thing over to Walsh, more or less, who had also arrived at Jodrell about the same time, and he took the thing over.
I see.
So that one stopped in about the mid-60s.
Okay, well, I'd like to ask you a general question about the group at Cambridge. It seems to me that it's a very coherent group that, you know, has always been close as compared with like CSIRO or NREO today.
Yes.
It's been
very stable membership too.
That's true. Yeah. Although some of the other places have too, but they haven't had this coherency. I was wondering if you could say how this came about, do you think?
I think it's largely a strong personality of Martin Ryle. It's also possibly a Cambridge phenomenon. I think it's actually hard to analyze this, because if you get a good, strong group growing anywhere, I think it may well do the same thing with cohering very well and staying coherent for a long time.
When you say a Cambridge phenomenon, you mean a tradition at the Cavendish Laboratory?
Cavendish and the Cambridge University as a whole. Cambridge is... it has a reputation, I think, perhaps rightly, of being somewhat an isolated place, and being quite content to get on its own.
In all sorts of scientific topics.
In all sorts of scientific topics, yes. I mean, it does very well on its own, of course, so it doesn't have to bother too much with other people. And it does, I think, carry on without too much reference with other people. And it does tend to produce coherent research groups which stick together.
I see. So the radio astronomy is not an exception, really.
I don't think so.
Okay, to close, you've made many useful remarks about the development of radio astronomy, but can you think of anything else as you look back, especially up to the early 60s, as to how the field went that you might like to say?
I think you covered it pretty well.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. That ends the interview with Graham Smith on 27 August 76.